Welcome to episode 7 in the 5th season of Justice with John Carpe, a podcast from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. I'm the show's producer, Kevin Steele, and with us today is John Carpe, the president and founder of the center. John's been studying the Online Harms Act, and he's been writing about it, and now he's here to tell us all about the problems with that federal legislation, not yet law. He's called it the worst attack on free expression in Canada ever. Okay, John, it's been a little over a week since the legislation became public. And so tell me, what are you seeing now?
Well, to be charitable, I should applaud the good intentions behind this. The Online Harms Act, it's the act to bring a lot of harm to us online by censoring our free expression. Now, it is laudable and honorable and worthwhile, in my view, to force the online platforms to social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, whatever else, to remove revenge porn, remove other kinds of non-consensual sharing of intimate images, including deepfakes created by artificial intelligence, remove content that bullies children or sexualizes children or encourages children to harm themselves, remove content that incites violence or hatred. Those are all good goals. What's interesting, though, is that this bill opens up the need to hire dozens or hundreds or thousands of new bureaucrats to police the internet, when in fact we already have almost all of these things are already criminal under the criminal code. For example, section 162.1 sub 1 of the criminal code prohibits online and offline publication of an intimate image without consent. So that's revenge porn. Any non-consensual publication of intimate images is already a criminal code offense. Section 163 of the criminal code prohibits obscene materials and child pornography. I think obscene materials has been interpreted back in the 1990s very, very liberally by the Supreme Court. So, you know, there's a lot of garbage that you can see online. But in any event, it's at least technically a criminal code offense to post obscene materials. Section 264 prohibits criminal harassment, which would cover a lot of bullying and intimidation. Section 319 of the criminal code, this is one most of our listeners have heard about before. This prohibits the public incitement of hatred towards an identifiable group, a group identifiable by race or ethnicity, religion, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression. No vaccination status is not on the list. I've been asked many times. So you will not run afoul of the Criminal Code of Canada if you willfully promote hatred against people who did not get the COVID shot. That is legal. But It's a criminal code offense to willfully promote hatred on the basis of race, ethnicity, religion, etc. You know, I've heard the Online Harms Act being justified by liberal politicians because it's going to criminalize violence and terrorism and so on. There's another criminal code offense. Is illegal to speak words of sedition. Sedition is advocating the use of force to achieve governmental change within Canada. So that's already criminal code. Criminal code offense to instruct people to carry out terrorist activities. Last but not least, section 22 of the criminal code makes it illegal to counsel, procure, solicit, or incite another person to be a party to an offense. So if you encourage somebody to commit murder, or you encourage somebody to steal a chocolate bar from a grocery store, if the person follows through and does the thing that you have incited them to do, you will be found criminally liable for counseling or inciting to commit a criminal code offense. So really, this is a whole bunch of new laws, and this is especially true for the new powers given to the Canadian Human Rights Commission. They used to have these powers up until 2014, so we've gone 10 years without having this government body prosecuting Canadians over non-criminal speech and, you know, responding to the likes of Richard Warman lawyer in Ottawa who was always filing these complaints, and he used to goad people and bait people online. He would go online pretending to be a neo-Nazi, and then he would encourage people to say certain things. Then he would file complaints against them, and conviction rate was close to 100%. So if you were getting prosecuted by the Canadian Human Rights Commission over something you said, then you're probably going to be found guilty. And the people who support – that was Section 13 as it then was, and I believe it's the same number coming back now, Section 13, which is going to give these enormous powers to the Canadian Human Rights Commissions to prosecute Canadians over non-criminal speech that the bureaucrats, almost all of whom will be woke, progressive, equity, diversity, inclusion types of people that are going to be highly offended by particularly by conservative speech, libertarian speech, religious speech. These people will have the power in their subjective assessment to determine what is hateful. And if they think that what you said is hateful, then you're going to be on the hook to pay a fine, which is going to be up to $50,000 that you have to pay to government, up to $20,000 that you have to pay to the victim. The victim does not need to prove any loss or damage other than feeling hurt or offended. And we don't even need a victim because you can file complaints anonymously. So somebody in Vancouver could file a complaint against a woman in Nova Scotia over disparaging remarks that she made about a mosque in Toronto. Even if the people that attend that mosque in Toronto are not offended by what she said, the guy in Vancouver can file a complaint and the Human Rights Commission can go after this woman and find her guilty, even if there's no victim other than the guy in Vancouver that just didn't like what she said.
Can I just add a little footnote to this? On the same day that the Online Harms Act came out, the story came out that a group has actually filed a complaint against the Canadian Human Rights Commission for racism.
Okay. Who did they file that with?
It's an international complaint, so let's just see. Let's see, an international complaint against the Human Rights Commission, nine organizations. No, it's nine organizations bringing it. Global Alliance of National Human Rights Institutions.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah,
so and their grounds for – why do they say the Canadian Human Rights Commission is racist?
Because they've discriminated against black people.
Oh.
In hiring.
Oh, interesting.
We'll have to see. It came out on the 26th of February, the same day that the Online Harms Act came out. I guess it must have got buried by that story anyway. Yeah, the same day that they get a promotion, they also get an international punch in the face.
Hmm. Well, this is going to open the doors for thousands of deeply offended busybodies to file human rights complaints against their neighbors, against political opponents, against whomever they want. Complaints can be anonymous, which is very regressive. Over the course of centuries, we have developed as part of our legal system a right to face your accuser and a right to cross-examine your accuser. Now, people would say correctly, well, that's just for criminal law and these are not criminal proceedings. But, you know, when you get prosecuted by the Human Rights Commission, not only can the fines be up to $70,000, which is a huge amount for just about anybody, but you're also going to incur the stress of getting prosecuted and you're likely to be spending tens of thousands of dollars on legal bills to defend yourself. The commission does not need to prove anything beyond a reasonable doubt. You cannot defend yourself on the basis of truth. Whereas in contrast with the Section 319 Criminal Code prohibition on hate speech, you can raise the defense of truth. So in other words, you could say, well, maybe what I said was hateful, but it happens to be true. And you can get acquitted on that basis. Not so with the human rights prosecutions. Truth is not a defense. They're not required to adhere to the stringent rules of evidence that real courts, this is a kangaroo court, so they can allow hearsay. They can allow in whatever evidence they want, exclude whatever they want, but they're not bound by the laws that govern real courts. So a lot of people, a lot of Canadians are going to self-censor because they don't want to face the risk of having a human rights complaint filed against them and then having this prosecution hang over them for years on end with the possibility of fines. Now, the Justice Center is going to do its best to step into the fray. If this law passes, the Justice Center will do its best to take on clients who are people that are getting prosecuted by the Canadian Human Rights Commission and get them lawyers so they have the pro bono legal representation. But we're going to be in the same situation that we've always been in, that we're in now, which is that we cannot say yes to every request because our resources are limited. So even though we've got a network of lawyers across Canada, there are full-time staff lawyers, about 9 of those, and then another dozen or more lawyers that are not staff lawyers, but that will take on cases. And so we have hundreds of cases, thanks to the generosity of Canadians that are donating to us. However, we are still, for a country of 40 million people, 9 full-time staff lawyers is not a huge number. So we're not going to be able to provide help to everybody that asks for it, even though we will do our best to help as many people as possible.
Yes, we cannot pretend to match the resources of the government, for heaven's sake, right? We take no government money, so.
That's right. And thank you to all the people that are donating to the Justice Center. We have in February, just recently, we sent out our official tax receipts to all of the people that gave to us in 2023. And if you have donated previously, please renew your support in 2024. All amounts are welcome. Some people give us $10,000 a year, some people $1,000 a year, some people $5,000 a year, some people $500 a year. Some people are giving us $10 a month, which is an amount that just about everybody can afford. $10 a month, $120 a year. It all adds up. We've got about 10,000 donors across Canada that are giving us money at various levels. So please go to www.jccf.ca and send us a donation. And then in February of 2025, we will send you out your official tax receipt. And that's what enables us to do the work, to hold the governments to account, to take the lead on fighting very serious anti-freedom laws like the Online Harms Act. We can do that work thanks to the generosity of donors. Another horribly disconcerting aspect of the Online Harms Act is a provision that authorizes judges to violate the liberty interests of Canadians based on what they might say. Yes, you heard that correctly. Not based on something they've said, based on something that they might say. So you can go to court, and if you think your next-door neighbor, Mark Smith, my apologies to any Mark Smiths that are listening out there, it's just an example name. I can go to court and tell the judge that I believe that my next-door neighbor, Mark Smith, is going to say something hateful, and the provincial court judge will then force Mark Smith will have to attend court because I went there and made a complaint. And if the judge believes me that I have a reasonable basis for my fear that Mark is going to promote genocide or hate or anti-Semitism or something he's going to say, the judge can then order Mark Smith to wear an ankle bracelet, to obey a curfew, to stay at home at designated hours, to abstain from alcohol or drugs or both, to provide blood or urine to confirm that he is abstaining from drugs or alcohol, that he not communicate with certain people, that he not go to certain places, and that he surrender his legally owned, legally acquired firearms. And all of that can happen to Mark Smith based on what he might say. If Mark Smith then disagrees with these conditions and doesn't abide by them, he can then face up to 2 years in jail. Again, not for anything he's done and not even for anything he's said, but based on what he might say. I'm in discussions with the legal team. We might be launching a proactive challenge on this particular point where a judge can violate your liberty. This is completely contrary to centuries of common law and criminal law which respect the rights and freedoms of every individual, one of which is to be presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in a fair trial before an independent and impartial court. And yet here we've got that that's tossed out the window with the Online Harms Act would actually allow people to have their freedoms violated by a court order, even though they haven't committed any crime at all.
Well, just to go back to what you said about launching an action there, I didn't quite understand what you were talking about, what kind of action you'd be launching and when. Maybe you could just describe that a little bit.
Yeah, so there's two kinds. One kind would be a situation where, let's say that this law passes, okay, which, I mean, if the Liberals and the NDP with their combined majority are both in favor of it, but never underestimate the power of political activism, because if your member of parliament is Liberal or NDP, if they get a lot of phone calls and emails from people who are against this legislation, that can influence them. Anyway, if this passes into law, the Justice Center would provide lawyers for Canadians that are getting prosecuted by the Human Rights Commission. That's one thing we would do. The other thing we can do is go into court and make an application to strike down this preemptive punishment when no crime has been committed. We could challenge that on its face, even without a client. Okay. That's usually not the way that we do our court actions. Usually you're better off to have a client and be able to present a real-life fact scenario before the court. But it is possible to go to court just on the face of what the bill says.
So you would be going in and actually asking a judge to strike down the law at that point?
To strike down this particular aspect, not the entire act. Most parts of the act, if you try to challenge it on the face of what it says, without a client whose rights or freedoms have been violated by the act, you're going to fall flat on your face and lose. So not the entire act, but the part of the act that would add this new section to the criminal code authorizing judges to violate the liberty interests of citizens, that is one aspect that conceivably, potentially, we could take to court just on the face of what it says.
But you're only in discussions now. That's what you're talking about. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right on. Okay.
Another disconcerting aspect is the increasing the penalty for advocating genocide. Currently in the Criminal Code of Canada, you can face up to 5 years in jail, which in my view should be enough of a deterrent for not for anything you've done, just for words that you have spoken or written. If you advocate genocide, you can spend up to 5 years in jail. Well, that's not good enough for the current government. They want to make that life imprisonment. So conceivably, if you, you know, raise your fist and say death to the fill in the blank religious, ethnic, racial group, if you advocate that a group of people be killed, which, by the way, I think is extremely reprehensible speech, and but to say that you could spend up to a lifetime in prison for that, a lot of people don't think through the practical implications. Since October the 7th, when Hamas massacred 1,200, whatever the number was, large number of Israeli civilians killed in cold blood. And then thereafter, we've had and we're still seeing the Israeli attack on Hamas in Gaza. And one of the cries that you will hear at pro-Palestinian protests is, quote, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, end of quote. There are Jewish people as well as non-Jewish people who say that that's a call for genocide. They want to kill every Jew in the state of Israel and make that Judenrein, Jewish-free Palestinian state. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. That means wipe Israel off the face of the earth. That means wipe out the Jews. Other people would say, no. That's not what it is at all. It's a very polemical, aggressive slogan, but it's a political slogan. You could have a free Palestine without killing any Jews. the Jews would still be there. Maybe they wouldn't be in charge anymore, but they would still be citizens of this new country, whatever, right? So you will have people debating both sides. And yet we've got a criminal code provision that even now, up to 5 years in jail. And this is not far-fetched or hypothetical. In Estonia and Germany and the Czech Republic, the authorities there have said that the slogan, quote, "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," end quote, is criminal speech in those three countries. In Calgary, where I live, a few months back, a man was arrested and charged by police for chanting, "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Charges were later stayed or withdrawn. So this is not far-fetched. This is the real-life thing of what happens when you criminalize speech, and you can have people charged with advocating genocide. That's a reality. I don't think that's reasonable to bump up the penalty from 5 years to life imprisonment.
Yeah, it's really a subjective judgment, isn't it? And it's also, there's a lot of context as well. You know, I mean, right now the context for that particular slogan that everybody was focusing on was in the context of this conflict that's going on, right? Had the conflict not been there, it might not have been treated so harshly. I'm not justifying it either way, but what I'm saying is, you know, the judgment call that has to be made, there's a lot of latitude there for these bureaucrats, and, you know, they can be swayed by their own prejudices.
The Supreme Court of Canada, in a case known as Saskatchewan Human Rights Tribunal versus Bill Whatcott, and it's often referred to, the shorthand is the Whatcott decision of the Supreme Court of Canada. And he had circulated some polemical flyers in Saskatchewan. This happened, of course, about a decade before the Supreme Court ruling came out, because it takes a long time for these cases to wind their way through first the human rights proceedings, because he was prosecuted by the Saskatchewan Human Rights Commission. He had some fairly polemical language, which is in the Supreme Court judgment, by the way. They tack on Appendix A and Appendix B. If you go to Canlii, C-A-N-L-I-I, Canadian Legal Information Institute, and then you click on to Federal Supreme Court, and then you search Whatcott, W-H-A-T-C-O-T-T, Whatcott, and you get a Supreme Court decision will pop up right away. And then you scroll down to the very end, and it's got these flyers. I want to read out what he got in trouble for. I think it's good for people to know.
In this context, yes, because we need examples. That's why the From the River to the Sea is a good example. I'd like to hear some more examples of, you know, how these things can be adjudicated when they're so vague.
I've just logged on to the Canlii website, and I very quickly found the Supreme Court of Canada decision in Whatcott versus Saskatchewan Human Rights Tribunal. I'm going to read from the, this is Appendix B to the Supreme Court judgment. Quote, "Keep homosexuality out of Saskatoon's public schools. It has come to the attention of the Christian Truth activists that a committee of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender issues set up by the Saskatoon Public School Board has recommended that information on homosexuality be included in their curriculum and school libraries. The Elementary School Teachers Union in Ontario voted this year in favor of this for grades 3 and 4, even though children at this age are more interested in playing Barbie and Ken rather than learning how wonderful it is for two men to sodomize each other. Children in Ontario perform poorly in terms of academics. However, their teachers seem more interested in sexual politics of a perverted type rather than preparing children to do well when they are older. Now the homosexuals want to share their filth and propaganda with Saskatchewan's children. They did it in Boston under the guise of, quote, safe schools, and their little sensitivity class degenerated into a filthy session where gay and lesbian teachers used dirty language to describe lesbian sex and sodomy to their teenage audience," end quote. Okay, so this is the kind of stuff that was on a flyer that got Bill Whatcott into trouble. Is this language offensive to a lot of Canadians? Yes, it would be. At the same time, those are his views. reading briefly from another Whatcott flyer. Again, I'm reading out of a Supreme Court of Canada decision. Quote, sodomites in our public schools, end quote. And there's a photo there, Toronto Gay Pride Parade. Looks to be a photo of a naked man with a kind of a black rectangle over their genitals. So the photo is not that graphic, but it shows that they're out in public, and goes on to criticize the University of Saskatchewan over hosting the fifth annual, quote, Breaking the Silence, quote, conference. There's another flyer, quote, Saskatchewan's largest gay magazine allows ads for men seeking boys. And then he quotes from there. One of the ads reads, quote, I'm 28 searching for boys/men for pen pals, friendship, exchanging rides, pics. Your age, looks, and nationality is not so relevant, end quote. So Bill Whatcott argues that this is inappropriate because it says, I'm 28, I'm searching for boys/men. And so he quotes that gay and lesbian classifieds with his own handwriting. He writes, Saskatchewan's largest gay magazine allows ads for men seeking boys. So for all of that, it got up to the Supreme Court of Canada, and they found that two of the flyers, they dismissed the complaint against Bill Whatcott, but two other flyers, they did not dismiss the complaint. But this is so subjective. I mean, whether you get offended by this or not is really going to vary from person to person. The Supreme Court in the Whatcott decision devoted over 4,000 words to trying to define hatred. And now we've got the Online Harms Act, where the government very proudly says, we're going to bring the law into alignment with what the Supreme Court of Canada has said. Right. Well, what the Supreme Court of Canada said is muddled, meandering. It's just a lack of clarity, where if it takes you 4,000 words to come up with a definition of hatred, you're not giving citizens the clarity that they deserve.
Yeah. Can I just interject here with something that's bothered me this last week? It has to do with the Online Harms Act and, you know, as far as everybody goes, praising the laudable parts of it. Now, you know, we've just had this, I guess, a few years now of people going to school board meetings, attempting to read out school books or show what is being taught in schools. And the thing I can't figure out is this. The things that they say they're trying to protect kids from, particularly the sexualization part, these are the same things they're teaching kids in public schools around the country. And, you know, I just don't get it. Maybe that's why I don't trust this idea of safety, because, you know, we've seen this problem, you know, what they're teaching in schools, and now they're saying, oh, well, we got to protect these kids from this, you know? Yeah, it's just, it seems, I don't know, it seems hypocritical in a sense.
Well, it's all about the children. If you listen to Justice Minister Arif Virani on Monday, he's got a few parents around him and wants to refer to and did refer to the tragic suicide of a teenager in Nova Scotia who I think intimate images of her were posted online without consent and so on. And he actually says that there are safety requirements for Lego to protect his children. And so in like manner, Canadians need the government to protect them in the same way that a parent would protect their child. The government's going to protect us from online harms and keep us safe. And it's a pretty frightening analogy for a number of reasons. One is that parents have a responsibility to protect their own children from the garbage that is on the internet. So if parents, and I gather a lot of parents are, they just let their kids spend as much time as they want on unsupervised access to the internet. Well, why are you doing that in the first place? That's not good parenting, in my view. Depending on age, of course. I mean, what, you know, once your teenager is 16 or 17 or 18, okay, fine. That, you know, that's different from a child who is 6 or 8 or 10. But it's kind of sad to see a government minister believing that the government is our parent and needs to manage us and control us and lead us and guide us as though we're children, and actually making the analogy in a news conference that there are safety requirements for Lego to protect his kids when they're playing with Lego, and so there need to be these safety requirements to protect children from online harms. And again, it's up to parents to make sure that their kids don't have unlimited, unsupervised access to the internet. So in its 4,000 words devoted to trying to define hate, the Supreme Court of Canada says that in human rights legislation, what is not allowed is emotions involving detestation or vilification. Okay, that's not allowed. However, you can express your disdain or dislike. So are you clear on that, Kevin? You can express your disdain or dislike for some group based on their religion, ethnicity, sexual orientation, whatever, the whole list. You can explain your disdain or dislike. That's okay. However, don't get into detestation or vilification.
Yes, 50 shades of disdain. Hmm. Not sure
how the other works. The other great clarity that the Supreme Court brought us in its Whatcott ruling is that it is a speech that discredits, humiliates, hurts, or offends is okay. So it is okay to talk about your, you know, the religious group, racial, ethnic group, sexual orientation, gender expression, gender identity. You can discredit them, you can humiliate them, you can hurt them, and you can offend them. And you can express your disdain or dislike. However, I warn you, do not get into the realm of detestation or vilification.
Okay.
So this is the clarity. There's the clarity that this legislation is going to seek to copy. Oh yeah, we're going to bring the law into line with the Supreme Court ruling in Whatcott. Great. Yeah. So now for your online speech, the Canadian Human Rights Commission can prosecute you if they feel that you've crossed this mysterious line. Nobody knows where this line is, but you've crossed the line away from discrediting, humiliating, hurting, offending, and expressing disdain or dislike, all of which is okay. Oh, but now you've crossed the line into detestation and vilification, and now you're going to be in trouble. And again, the process is the punishment. I mean, if you get this is what Yaniv did in British Columbia to these poor, vulnerable immigrant women that were represented by the Justice Center. Yaniv at that time, Yaniv is born male and at that time, perhaps still today, but at that time had male genitalia. And Yaniv would phone these women asking for a Brazilian bikini wax, which I'm not even sure if I even knew what that was until Yaniv arrived on the scene. And
yay for
and
him.
educated the whole world about Brazilian bikini waxes. And I learned, for example, that there's a different procedure for a manzillion, and they use a different kind of wax, and there's a risk of injury anyway. But this Brazilian bikini wax was a service provided by women, often working in their own homes with small children present. Women provide that service to other women, okay? And so Yaniv would phone up and say, you know, hi, this is, you know, I'm Yaniv, and I want to book an appointment with you. And the woman receiving the call would say, I'm sorry, we don't do men, we don't do transgender, it's just like the service is only for women. He would then file a human rights complaint against that woman, and they were terrified, a lot of them, because they're new to Canada, they've never been in trouble with the law, and here you get this nasty official letter from the Human Rights Tribunal telling you that a human rights prosecution is being opened up against you. And so the Justice Center represented many of these women. Unfortunately, there was many of them that settled. Here's another thing that goes on is Yaniv would say to these women, look, you know, pay me $5,000 or pay me $3,000 and I'll go away. And to this day, we still don't know, because the BC Human Rights Tribunal refuses to provide this information. We don't know how much money Yaniv possibly received from threatening these women. One of them.
Shakedown is the word.
Shakedown. That's the title of Ezra Levant's book, as relevant today as it was 10, 15 years ago when written, Shakedown. Mm-hmm. One of the women went to 17 different law firms asking for legal representation, and every single one of them turned her down because they did not want to be publicly maligned or publicly viewed as transphobic. That's the state of the legal profession these days, where, you know, when I was a kid, lawyers were admired for being principled, you know, so principled even to the point of offending or, you know, being the only guy in town to stand up for something. Well, those days are gone, but, but the Justice Center represented these women, and, one of our staff lawyers had to cross-examine Yaniv on the stand during the human rights hearing as to whether Yaniv still had male genitalia, to which Yaniv eventually admitted that, yes, he did. He was very evasive and tried to avoid the question. But you know, my colleague had never thought that he'd be cross-examining anybody about that topic, but he did. And
had to get done.
Had to get done. So the big problem, Kevin, is going to be the self-censorship. You and I and a lot of other people are going to continue to speak freely as we always have, but there's going to be a lot of Canadians that will self-censor to avoid the risk of getting prosecuted by the Canadian Human Rights Commission. So we have to fight hard back against this. And the best thing citizens can do is to contact their own member of parliament and urge their MP to vote against the Online Harms Act. If you want the ammunition for that, we've got a 4-page information flyer that can be found on our website. We've also circulated a petition. It already has, I think, well over 10,000 signatures in just the past few days. And you can find that on our website as well. We're hoping to get at least 50,000 signatures in the next few weeks and find a way to present those to the House of Commons or the federal government in particular.
Just going back to this problem with the Supreme Court's definition of hate and disdain and vilification and all of that, it may not be deliberately vague, but because it is vague, there's too much discretion there. People can go after people they don't like for political speech and forgive other people, you know, by simply, shifting the lines here or there a little bit. You know, it just provides so much uncertainty. And I think that's a problem with the law as well, the fact that there is uncertainty, you know. Everybody, I think you've made this point several times, everybody should know what the law says, where they stand. You know, the fact is they don't know where they stand, and maybe that's where they want us to be so that we do self-censor.
Yeah. Well, then some people, they say, look, you know, don't worry about it. We can trust the government to crack down only on the really bad stuff. It's like, mm-hmm. Well, this is why we've got a criminal code offenses already. The willful promotion of hatred against an identifiable group is already a criminal code offense. A lot of people would argue that that already is too much of a violation of free expression, and that already creates too much of a chilling effect. But at least with that criminal code provision against the willful promotion of hatred, you have the defense of truth, and the Crown has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you intended to promote hatred, not only that your words were hateful. So there's a pretty high bar. And it's not that often that we hear about people getting prosecuted for criminal hate speech, which is another problem. It's free and cheap and easy to file a complaint with the Canadian Human Rights Commission. We're going to have thousands of people filing complaints against their next door neighbor, or again, more often against their political opponents. I don't mean political limited only to the House of Commons or the provincial legislature, like not in the partisan sense, but political opponents, like people that you disagree with about issues, about whatever, abortion or immigration or climate change or taxes or whatever else. People can file anonymous complaints against their opponents. just as a way to throw a wrench into somebody else's bicycle, suck up their time and energy. This is going to become very political very quickly. And this will leave it to the bureaucrats working for the Canadian Human Rights Commission to determine what is hateful. But hate, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder. Let me give you some practical examples. Is it hateful towards Islam to denounce religiously inspired terrorism and other violence carried out in the name of Islam? Is it hateful to denounce the absence of religious freedom and women's rights in Iran and Saudi Arabia and other Muslim countries? Is it hateful to criticize certain passages of the Quran? Is it hateful to single out Israel when denouncing military operations while ignoring or even celebrating conduct of other actors that are engaging in similar conduct? Is it hateful for individuals to share publicly about having experienced a change in their own sexual orientation? Is that homophobic? Is that hateful towards gay people if somebody were to share that? Is it hateful or is it transphobic to advocate against giving puberty blockers and opposite sex hormones to teens under 18? Is it hateful to make the argument that it is just not possible to become the opposite sex, which is an argument that people are making every day, is that it's futile for a boy to become a girl or a woman, and it's futile for a girl to become a boy or a man, that it's just impossible. Is it hateful to say that? Is it hateful for Muslims, Orthodox Jews, theologically conservative Christians to describe gay sex as sinful? Is that hateful? Is it hateful for a religious adherent to proclaim that her faith is the only sure way to get to heaven? And there I'm thinking of Christianity and Islam, which I'm not a theologian, but to my understanding, both faiths make that claim, that they are the only way to get to heaven. Is it hateful for an adherent of a faith to say that her faith is the only way to get to heaven? And so for each of these questions, there'll be good people that argue yes, good people who argue no, based on their own subjective assessments. And this is the problem with criminalizing the expression of hate, because hate is an emotion, it's subjective, and even more of a problem when you expand it beyond the criminal code and put it into human rights legislation. The commission, you have no idea what the law is, what's going to get you in trouble or not.
Yes, as I said, this is the principle of making the law easily understood by everybody so that they can find, you know, they can figure out what side they're on or where, you know, whether they're on the side of the law. But if the law is vague and confusing, people will simply retreat. And that's unhealthy for the nation. Although, you know, it's healthy for people that want to maintain or grab power. You know, I mean, it's they go in unopposed then.
Yeah. The other huge problem is that the Online Harms Act gives new powers to the federal cabinet to make regulations to declare, to write into law what is going to be allowed and not allowed, what is permitted, what is not permitted, etc. And this law itself, the Online Harms Act, will be debated before Parliament, first reading, second reading, third reading. There may or may not, depending on the speed at which the Liberals and NDP use their combined majority to push it through. I don't know if there will be hearings before a committee. But in any event, the law is going to be debated in Parliament. But the law also says that the cabinet, known as the Governor in Council, the cabinet has power to make regulations. And this act gives very broad powers to the federal government to make all kinds of regulations about what is legal or illegal in terms of social media services. These regulations are going to be enforced by an online safety commission, which, if it sounds creepy, it should. It was the Committee for Public Safety in revolutionary France that was responsible for chopping off people's heads with the guillotine. That was the Committee for Public Safety. So now we have an online safety commission to keep all of us safe. And that's going to be staffed by new bureaucrats. So we see a growth in government that is coming along here with the new Online Safety Commission and with the Canadian Human Rights Commission, no doubt hiring a lot more people to start policing our speech.
Well, that would follow the trend. The current government has expanded the civil service by something like 40% since 2015. So I guess an extra 2,000 to 5,000 people, not going to make a huge bit of difference, is it? Well, it will, of course, to the law of the land.
Yeah, it'll make this is the worst assault on free expression in modern Canadian history. Full stop. This is massive. All for the children, of course. This brings me to another point. There's a column which I've not yet submitted, but I'm just done writing, talking about Canada's maternal fascism. 100 years ago, as those who are students of history will know, that there were fascist movements in the majority of European countries in the 1920s and 30s. They actually took power in Germany and Italy, as well as Spain, Portugal, Croatia, Hungary. So the fascists were in power, and in places where they were not in power, they had fascist movements in Britain, in Norway, in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in France, and pretty much every country in Europe had fascist movements. The fascists of 100 years ago, they hated the individual rights and freedoms. They hated what we would call classical liberalism, this idea of a limited government and maximum individual freedom, where people can choose their own goals, choose their own priorities, live their own lives as they deem best. And you have the rule of law, so the law applies equally to everybody. You have equality of opportunity. You don't have equality of results. So in a classical liberal society, you will have different levels of wealth. But the rule of law serves to give everybody an opportunity, that everybody has an equal opportunity to start a business, run a business, to move, to travel, to say what you want, think what you want, do what you want, as long as it's not harming other people, etc. And so the fascists in Europe, they hated this, and because they want to rally everybody around government-dictated objective, right? It's not good enough for you and I to have different goals and priorities. No. Both of us have to be marching behind. You know, we're all in this together. We've got to be behind this big objective.
Social now, harmony. Yes.
The objectives changed. The censorship impulse is as old as mankind itself, and it's not limited to fascists only. You've got communists, and you've got theocrats, and you've got other types of repressive regimes that will also censor free speech. But it's a very fascist characteristic. The fascists in the 1920s, 1930s were so thoroughly convinced that their beliefs were correct that they felt quite confident in silencing other people, and they would often use violence to do it. So you'd have these nationalist thugs in jackboots marching through the streets, chanting nationalist slogans, and if they came across a member of some ethnic or religious minority that they didn't like for, or if they came across a political opponent, they would beat you up. They might go ransack your store and smash in the windows, do this or that. Certainly break up other people's political meetings. And so they were violent, and they weren't secretly violent. They were quite proud of that. And unfortunately, some people like that. They were impressed by that violence. These were popular movements. You know, the fact that they took power in several countries, less popular in some places. They didn't get very far in Britain. In Norway, they got up to 2% of the vote at one point. I think of the Netherlands, the Dutch fascists at one point got 8% of the vote. But just the fact that they were present and organized in every country in Europe. Now, today we've got something similar in terms of the hostility to individual rights and freedoms and this arrogant notion, people who are so convinced that their opinions are correct that they feel comfortable and confident in silencing other people and taking away their speech. And so in this column I've written, I'm calling this a maternal fascism. And so it's not the old kind from 100 years ago where you've got these violent thugs marching through the streets and smashing in store windows. The new maternal fascism they will never give you a black eye. They will instead, in a very civilized fashion, they'll commence a human rights prosecution against you. They'll force you to spend tens of thousands of dollars on legal bills if the Justice Center is not able to take on your case. And they will subject you to a financial penalty of having to pay the government up to $50,000, having to pay a victim up to $20,000 because the victim feels offended. And they will monitor and regulate what you say. They will have an army of bureaucrats working for the Canadian Human Rights Commission, the Online Safety Commission. And it's all for your own good. Because in the eyes of the Justice Minister, Arif Virani, we are helpless children. And so we need him as a domineering, busybody mother to look after her helpless children. And so this domineering mother is going to control and manage every aspect of the lives of her children for their own good, for their own safety, because she loves them so much. So this is how the government views us. We can't handle, you and I can't decide for ourselves what is true or false. You and I are not strong enough to refute lies and falsehoods on the internet. We need the government to do that on our behalf. So this is kind of, it's a maternal fascism in the sense that it's taking away our free speech rights, which the fascists did 100 years ago. So there's a parallel there. And it's also forcing everybody to rally behind this public goal of safety and the related goals, of course, diversity, inclusion, equity. The government wants everybody marching together in lockstep behind these goals. And so we have this Canada's maternal fascism, where government, for our own good, for our safety, is going to take away our rights and freedoms, in particular the freedom of speech. Is going to be severely harmed if this law passes Parliament and comes into force.
Yes, Mother Virani is going to be there to make sure we don't swallow the Lego of hate speech.
Oh, brilliant. In closing, I will mention a few things that that other people have said in the past week. RCMP Commissioner Mike Duhem welcomed the legislation, which I find disappointing, but I guess it is what it is. I'd rather have the RCMP protecting us from murderers and rapists and those who would break and enter into our homes, and the white-collar fraud, those peddling child pornography. There are so many bad and terrible things prohibited by the criminal code. So to have the RCMP, if they don't get extra resources, it means that if the RCMP is going to get into this business of trying to help to enforce the Online Harms Act, that will mean fewer resources available to prevent car theft. But this is
not preventing it now, so come on.
Michael Geist, a law professor at the University of Ottawa, talks about the breadth of power of the Online Safety Commission. The breadth of powers is remarkable. Questions about commission oversight and accountability will be essential. So he's quite worried about it, that the federal cabinet's going to have this new power to make all kinds of regulations. There's huge, wide latitude. And then you've got the Online Safety Commission with its army of bureaucrats to enforce whatever regulations are passed by Parliament. Some interesting side commentary about online pornography that has been addressed as well. Under the Online Harms Act, the social media services will be required to remove child pornography within 24 hours, and other objectionable content. I'm not sure we need a whole new bill for that. I'm surprised that the criminal code doesn't include that requirement. You could simply amend the criminal code to say it is a criminal offense for a social media service to keep pornography online and available for viewing once it's been brought to their attention, or, you know, whatever. You could do a criminal code amendment for that. You don't need this enormous, gigantic new bill with new powers to the Online Safety Commission and the Canadian Human Rights Commission. One of the questions that comes up is on how to protect minors from viewing pornography on the internet. And how is that done? I mean, do you ask for ID? And then that raises other questions. Do we want a government-issued ID for everybody, which we don't? Even the parties in the House of Commons have said that they don't want a government-issued ID. But then do you want people to register their faces or their credit card numbers with these companies? It just seems to be it seems to be a practical problem. But just in passing, I was reading here that laws requiring internet porn sites to verify a user's age have been passed in several U.S. states. Quote, after Louisiana required that a government ID be used to access Pornhub, traffic took a nosedive. The company is fighting the bill and argues any regulation that requires sites to collect significant amounts of highly sensitive personal information will put user safety in jeopardy. So I just thought that was interesting that there's states that will say, well, you want to look at porn online, you have to provide your driver's license to show that you're old enough to do this. And then I don't know the details of how that works. Do they have a camera that matches your face with your face on your driver's license? Who knows?
Maybe they could have a little box that you could check. I'm just here to read the articles. For those young enough not to know what I'm talking about, that goes back to the 1960s with the advent of Playboy publishing very, very good articles by well-known authors. And it was common to say, I just buy it for the articles, you know. So. Hate when you have to explain a joke.
Yeah. I guess it's one of those bank jokes where only the teller laughs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Carson Jurema of
banned. Sorry,
Carson Jurema, who is editor of the National Post, wrote a fantastic column that I highly recommend. And I'll quote from Carson Jurema's column briefly. Quote, however, even though the government is using language from the Supreme Court to define hate speech, the difference between detestation, which is hate speech, and disdain or dislike, which is not hate speech, are hardly easy or obvious distinctions, even for lawyers. They come down to the subjective opinions of, first, those filing the complaints, and second, government bureaucrats tasked with deciding whether such complaints are valid enough to be subjected to a full inquiry. Ask yourself, what's the difference between detestation and disdain? Carson Jurema goes on to say, under the previous Section 13 regime, judgments siding with the complainant was near 100%. Unlike cases of civil defamation and criminal prosecution of hatred, truth is no defense. And so people could face hefty fines for saying entirely true things if those facts are determined to foment hate. Campbell Clark in the Globe and Mail states, quote, yet in legislation such as this, there is potential for overreach that should be taken seriously. That could be in bad definitions of hate speech, too much left to regulations rather than legislation, or too much interpretive power given to police or other authorities. It could also set onerous but ineffective rules. Andrew Coyne in the Globe and Mail complains about a new standalone hate crime. Quote, at present, hatred as a motive for crime can be taken into consideration at sentencing. But now, under the Online Harms Act, it would be a crime in itself, not only to commit an offense motivated by hatred under the criminal code, but under any other act of Parliament. What difference this might make can be debated. What's really objectionable is the proposed penalty, up to life in prison. The underlying act doesn't even have to be a crime. So commit an offense under, say, the Canada National Parks Act, but if you do so with hate in your heart, in theory, you could be facing life.
Holy cow. Yeah, that's an interesting angle.
John Iveson of the National Post says, the danger is that we have gone from the digital Wild West to a surveillance state with the stroke of a pen.
Well, we're not quite there yet, but we're getting ready to go. I should say at the Justice Center, it sounds like you're getting ready to stop it from going. Help, anyway. All right, John, thanks so much for being here for this episode of Justice with John Carpe. You are in the name of the show, so I assume you're happy to be here. And I want to say that I hope to talk to you again real soon.
Talk to you next week, Kevin. Take care.